We're here in the neighborhood at 10:32 this morning to do Dave's Gone By. Lot of guests, lot of stuff to do on this episode of the show. But first things first, I want to get to our very first guest. He's on the telephone with us, and he's going to talk about the late, great comedian Red Fox, who, of course, we all know from Sanford and Son, or maybe your parents and grandparents kind of remember him from the party records that he used to do. One of the most influential comics, really, of all time, of the modern era, even though he's probably not mentioned in the same breath, as I said, as George Carlin or Richard Pryor or Lenny Bruce. And yet, he made inroads into the subject matter and the way that comedy is mass distributed in a way that those guys didn't even do, or at least he paved the way for them to do what they did. And so to talk about Red Fox is the author of the book Black and Blue, the Red Fox story. Michael Starr, he's on the telephone with us. Michael, can you hear me, and can I hear you?
Yeah, Dave, I can hear you.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, you sound great. Great. Good. Okay. Well, welcome to the neighborhood.
Thank you.
So, you wrote the Red Fox story, I guess, it just came out last year. How long did it take you to put the book together?
It took about 3 years, and it was timed to come out, to coincide with the 20th anniversary of Red's death. He died in October of 1991 on the set of his newest show at that time, which was a CBS sitcom called The Royal Family. And it was good timing, too, because then this past January, a couple of months back, was the 40th anniversary of Sanford and Son, which, of course, as you mentioned in your intro, Red is best known for. So it took about 3 years, and I really learned a lot about Red. I mean, I knew some stuff about him going in, but I really learned some surprising factoids about Red Fox. And as you mentioned, he really was extremely influential on a whole generation of stand-up comedians. Although I would agree with you, you know, his name is usually not mentioned in the same breath as Carlin or Richard Pryor or Eddie Murphy or even Bill Cosby, but he really did influence all of those performers.
Well, I'm kind of wondering, were you commissioned to do the book, or was it your idea? Like, okay, I want to do another biography, and Red Fox just kind of called out to you.
It was a combination of both. I had first approached a publisher about this idea over 10 years ago. And I got the okay, but a long, boring story. It was just, you know, a business decision was made that they didn't want to do the book. So in the meantime, I wrote a couple of other books, but I always had Red Fox in the back of my mind. And I had done a biography of Raymond Burr, which came out in 2008, mm-hmm. and the publisher liked that book. So, you know, they came back to me and said, well, you know, we know you really want to do Red Fox, so, you know, why don't we go ahead? And as I mentioned, the timing was great. To tie it into Red, the 20th anniversary of Red's death, and the premiere of Sanford and Son in 1972. So it all worked out, and it was a fun book to research. It was a fun book to write, and you know, Red was he certainly was an individualist, and certainly there was he stuck to his guns throughout his entire career, and there was just so much ground to cover from his beginnings. You know, he wanted to be a singer in the beginning of his career. When that didn't work out, he turned to stand-up comedy and relationships with Malcolm X, when he was known as Malcolm Little in Harlem in the 1940s. Those two were, Red was very good friends with him. And as you mentioned in your intro, the party records and breaking through in the clubs in a big way in the 1960s, all leading eventually to Sanford and Son in 1972. And then after that, a good run on that and sort of his downfall in the years after Sanford and Son, after he left the show.
Well, okay, let's even roll it back a little bit, because I've been certainly enjoying the book, or the beginning of the book that I've had the time to read. I think you, so far it seems like you're doing a really wonderful job. One of the things I wanted to compliment you on is, like, there's a section where he and his group, Kenny Wiggs and the Wiggs, what was the band that he was?
That was in 1946. Red was trying to launch a musical career. He wanted to be a singer, so he put out 6 R&B sides on a label called Savoy Records, which was a pretty big jazz label located here on the East Coast in Newark, New Jersey. And he was good enough to pass an audition, and he did cut 6 sides with a guy named the backing band was Kenny Watson. I think it was his Brooklyn buddies, Brooklyn Six, I think, as you mentioned. The Savoy did publicize, you know, the records, and you know, I have photos of, you know, the ads that they took out in Billboard magazine and everything, and they didn't sell. You know, Red was not singing was not his forte. He didn't have a terrible voice. It wasn't the kind of voice that everybody today remembers him for. You know, that gravelly, gruff cigarette voice that he had later on in his life when he hit it big on Sanford and Son. In the early days, I mean, this was when he was 23, 24 years old. He had a pretty melodious sounding voice, but it was a tough business, and he couldn't make it as a singer. So he serendipity led him to a comedy club in Baltimore called Gambies. Mm-hmm. And from then on, he discovered he had a knack for telling jokes and interplay with the audience and shouting down hecklers, and he really started to forge his comedy career. And you know, the rest, as they say, Dave, is history. One thing led to another, and
right. Well, actually, let's stick on the very early history, because you know, thanks to some of the wonderful world of Google and YouTube, I was able to track down one of Red Fox's early records, one of the numbers that he did on those old 78s. So I do want to play it. It's called Lucky Guy, and I don't know if I'll get a chance to play the whole thing, but let's give a listen, if you don't mind, to hearing what Red Fox sounded like, although he was already using the name Red Fox at this point.
Yes, he was. He had already switched over several years before from his birth name, which was John Sanford. He had changed his name to Red Fox. So that is the name he recorded under.
So let's hear a little bit of Lucky Guy, and then we'll have more with Michael Starr, the author of Black and Blue, The Red Fox Story. Lucky Guy, going way, way back to the 78 era. And you can, I mean, if you didn't tell me that was Red Fox, I would have no clue. I was just thinking he was a journeyman, kind of, you know, hep, jive, blues sort of singer. But I also wanted to talk to Michael Starr about still those early years. You kind of just let it go as an aside there, that he ran for a while with Malcolm X, and they were very, very close friends. So can you tell us
they
a little bit about
Red,
that?
Had moved to, he was still known as John Sanford at that time, had made his way to Harlem in the late 30s, early 40s, and he got a job as a dishwasher at a restaurant called Jimmy's Chicken Shack, which was a very well-known place in those days. It was a big hangout for African-American entertainers passing through town. And it was there that he met a fellow who was a waiter there, a guy named Malcolm Little. And they became very, very good friends. They had a whole bunch of schemes, money-making schemes. They chased women together, smoked some pot, dealt some pot, were very close. And Malcolm Little later became Malcolm X.
But the interesting thing, and I heard you mention this in another interview, was that they kind of stopped running together because Malcolm X was getting to... Excuse me, I can't talk this morning, was getting into some heavier criminal activity than Red was. Red wasn't...
Yeah, I mean, it eventually, Malcolm Little, later being Malcolm X, eventually did serve some time in prison. And I think it was a combination of that, a combination of he was already at that point, Malcolm Little was sort of getting more into politics and you know, the sort of thing that would make him very, very famous later on, whereas Red just wanted to have a good time, wanted to be funny, you know, just wanted to chase girls. And so they sort of, when World War II broke out, they sort of parted ways, and they didn't really keep in touch after that. There is a photo in the book from the early 60s when Red did go to meet, to visit then Malcolm X in Harlem in the 60s in a restaurant. Just to stop by to say hello, because Red was performing in Harlem at that time. And, you know, Red was, after Malcolm X was assassinated, several members of the press reached out to Red to get his reaction and that kind of thing. But after their Harlem years, they didn't really keep in touch, and Red was busy with his career, and Malcolm Little was serving time in prison, and he was busy with his career. So their paths never really intertwined after that. But they did spend 2 or 3 years in Harlem as very, very close friends, and as a matter of fact, they had nicknames. Malcolm Little was known as Detroit Red, and John Sanford at that time was known as Chicago Red, because he had grown up in Chicago, and Malcolm Little had grown up in Detroit, and the name Red was because of their complexions. They had very sort of copper-type complexions, Red Fox had some American Indian, but on his mother's side, some Native American blood, so his complexion was a little copper in color.
And they had
the same sort of ginger colored hair, so they both got they both were nicknamed Chicago Red and Detroit Red to sort of separate them to people who didn't know them too well.
Actually, one of the things that's interesting in starting to read the book also is that if you watch the TV show Sanford and Son, it seems like a lot of the names of the characters were taken from, you know, Red Fox's real family life. I mean, Sanford was his real name. You know,
that's right. He had a brother named Fred Sanford, who Red idolized, and who passed away in the mid-60s. He was sort of a very troubled soul who was never quite found his way in life, was in and out of prison, was a terrific athlete, but actually had a tryout once with the Chicago White Sox, but at that time baseball wasn't yet integrated, so that didn't go anywhere. But yeah, so when NBC made Sanford and Son, which they borrowed from a British BBC comedy called Steptoe and Son, Red said, well, you know, why don't we just call it Sanford, and let's call my character Fred Sanford in honor of his brother. And his son, Lamont, was named after a friend and the character of Grady, who was played by Whitman Mayo.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Lamont was played by a guy named...
oh, my gosh.
Why am I blanking on his name?
He's a preacher now.
Damon Wilson.
Damon Wilson, right, yeah.
And his real name is Grady Damon Wilson, so they used Grady as the character for Whitman Mayo's character. And there were several other characters. Lamont was named after one of Red's childhood friends named Lamont Owsley, who he had grown up with in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And there was a Reverend Trimble, who was named after one of Red's friends named Steve Trimble, who he was in a band with when he was in high school. And also one of Red's, this wasn't a character named after anybody in particular, but one of the primary actress on Sanford and Son was LaWanda Page, who played Aunt Esther.
Sure.
And she and Red had grown up, they went to the same elementary school in St. Louis, which is where Red was born. So he had known her all his life, and he actually got her the job on Sanford and Son. She, like Red, had toured the Chitlin circuit, which was the segregated stand-up comedy circuit and variety circuit, and had absolutely no TV experience. And Red had her flown in to Los Angeles from St. Louis, and she auditioned for the role, which she won, and then the producers of Sanford and Son wanted to fire her because she couldn't sort of adapt to the rhythms of television and a TV script. So Red promised to work with her, which he did, and she nailed it, and the rest is history. She went on to be almost as best known a character, almost as well known as Fred Sanford on that show, you know, with her interaction with Fred.
Those remain for me the funniest elements of the show. I mean, just when they're doing the dozens on each other, it's just marvelous. And people, when I was a kid watching Sanford and Son, I had no idea that there was that layer of irony there, that Aunt Esther is this prudish church-going lady, you know, with a temper, obviously. And then LaWanda Page was, I guess, as dirty a nightclub comic as Red was in his
day. Yes, and back in the day had a pretty provocative act called the Goddess of Fire, where she would come out very scantily clad and light candles with flames on her fingertips. I think that was the way they described it, but... Yeah, and the fact that they had known each other all their lives, I think, definitely helped with the on-screen chemistry. And it was sort of like two old friends talking to each other and sort of beating each other down. And you can tell when you watch a show how much they enjoy working with each other.
Oh yeah, that's you can't miss it. I mean, it's wonderful. But one of the things I wanted to get to, and I talked a couple of months ago to now I'm blanking on her name. But the singer-comedienne who came up with the novelty song Bounce Your Boobies and a lot of the proto-women's lib comedy. Help me out here. She's played.
I'm thinking, and I can't.
Played a lot on Dr. Demento. Oh, forgive me for not remembering this, but if you scroll back on the list of guests who've appeared on Dave's Gone By... Well, anyway, one of the things that she said was, I mean, she had the nightclub gig and she did, you know, very, very well for herself, but she was also one of those first people who made it big on the party record circuit. I mean, it wasn't on the Billboard charts, it wasn't being shown anywhere, but she was selling more records and brown paper wrappers and under the counter than, you know, half the people who were being measured by Your Hit Parade and the Top 100. And of course, Red Fox was part of that circuit, too.
Yeah, I mean, his first party record, which was called Laugh of the Party, L-A-F-F, Laugh of the Party, went gold. I mean, he was paid $25 by a guy named Dootsie Williams, who had a label called Dudo Records. And, you know, he paid Red $25 to
What? It wasn't $25? Hello?
He was paid, yeah, $25 by a goodbye Dootsie Williams to record his act. And, you know, Red said, okay, well, whatever. You know, he thought nothing of it. He was playing a club called the Brass Rail in Los Angeles as a solo act. Dootsie Williams came in with his tape recorder, recorded Red's act, you know, over the course of a couple nights, put out this record called Laugh of the Party, which went gold. I mean, it was amazing. And he made quite a mint off of, over the next 8 or 9 years, off of these Red Fox party records. You know, there's Laugh of the Party 2, Laugh of the Party 3, and then they just branched out. So it was Red was really the forerunner, I think, in that genre, and that's really how he made a name for himself. Eventually, those party records, which played to a predominantly African-American audience in the beginning, crossed over to the mainstream. You know, white college kids started listening to them, and then he became sort of this underground hero. Not quite in the Lenny Bruce vein, but close.
Yeah, I mean, it's by the way, Rusty Warren was the name of
Knockers Up.
That's it. Yes. Sorry, Rusty. I'm forgive me for not remembering your name.
But yeah, you're right. You're right, Dave. She was. As a matter of fact, if you go to like an old record shop and you go to the comedy album displays, it's always, you know, it's always Red Fox and Rusty Warren are always the first two you find.
That's right. Yeah. So how did he have to audition for Sanford and Son, or was the role tailor made for him?
It's a little bit of both. Norman Lear and Bud York and the producers of the show had a hit the year before with All in the Family for CBS, which they had borrowed from a BBC show called Till Death Do Us Part, which was extremely popular in the UK in the 60s. And they had so much success with that they went back to the well and they said, okay, well, you know, we'll take another show, which was called Steptoe and Son, which was about a junk man and his son in the East End of London,
right,
called Wilfred Bramble and Harry Corbett, and was a huge hit in England on the BBC. So they bought the rights to it, but they didn't quite know how to cast. They knew they wanted an ethnic bent to the show, but they didn't quite know what ethnicity. They tried a Jewish version, they tried an Italian version with Paul Sorvino, they tried an Irish version with, I forget who, maybe it was Barnard Hughes, I don't remember. But nothing seemed to work. And then an actor named Cleavon Little, a very, very fine actor, people might remember him from Blazing Saddles.
Sure.
Was a friend of Red's, and he mentioned to Bud York, and he said, you know, you should take a look at this guy, Red Fox. You go check him out. Red had made a movie called Cotton Comes to Harlem in 1970, which was directed by Ossie Davis, and Godfrey Cambridge was in that movie, and it was a very well-known movie of his time. And in the movie, Red played a junk man. It was perfect.
Oh.
His name was Uncle Bud in the movie, who looked almost exactly like Fred Sanford would look in Sanford and Son. So Yorkin went to see the movie, fell in love with Red, and he felt that he had the star of the show, you know, because they wanted to set it in a junkyard. They wanted to make it a little edgy by setting it in Watts, which had been the scene of some race riots several years before in L.A. And they called Red up. They got in touch with Red, and strangely enough, he didn't want the role because at that time he was more focused on doing a cooking show with his wife. That he said he wanted to sort of air locally in Las Vegas. He had a house in Las Vegas because he was such a big draw in Vegas. And he sort of had to be talked into, well, I think when he found out how much money could be made, he was all in. But so Bud Yorkin flew out to Las Vegas, met with Red. They hit it off. And then they flew out Damon Wilson, who had been on an episode of All in the Family, so he was sort of known to Bud Yorkin and Norman Lear. And they flew him out to meet Red. Those two hit it off. They read through the script. Everything seemed to be great. And they, right then and there, they said, okay, well, you know, we'll go back to L.A. in a few weeks and we'll shoot the pilot, which they did around Christmas time in 1971. Now, keep in mind at this time, and I always find this interesting too, because people think of Fred Sanford as this really, really old man. Well, Red was only 49 when he shot that pilot. He was actually 49 for the whole first season of Sanford and Son.
Wow.
But, I mean, he was supposed to, the character of Fred Sanford was supposed to be 65, but, you know, they grayed up Red's hair. He grew that scraggly beard. And his voice, though, really was like that at that time. You know, he'd spent so many years in the clubs and smoking cigarettes and snorting coke and, you know, smoking pot. It had really sort of added that timbre to his voice. But he did adopt that sort of that bow-legged shuffle and, you know, stooped his back a little bit and transformed himself into Fred Sanford. And when they shot the pilot, they shot it on the CBS, at the CBS studios in L.A., and they invited the cast of All in the Family to come watch, and they said that they were just rolling on the floor laughing. They shot, I think it was two scenes, actually, early on. But strangely enough, Yorkin and Lear could not get CBS interested. And I don't know, it might have been a race thing, or maybe they just didn't want to, you know, they had gone through a lot of headaches with All in the Family, which, as we know, was a huge show and turned out to be a huge show. So what Bud Yorkin did was he invited Fred, Herb Schlosser, who was the president of the West Coast Entertainment Division of NBC.
NBC, yeah.
Yeah, NBC sort of snuck him in the back door through CBS and had him up in the stands watching this pilot tape. And at the end of the pilot, you know, Schlosser went down and said to Bud Yorkin, you know, you got yourself a series. Let's, you know, we're going to put it on the air in another month. So they rushed back. They shot the first episode, and sure enough, Sanford and Son did premiere on NBC in January of 1972 and shot right up to number two, right behind All in the Family.
Wow.
Which didn't make CBS happy. I'm sure they were kicking themselves that they didn't buy the show.
And so the rest
is history. I mean, for most of its run, the first 4 or 5 years, Sanford and Son and All in the Family kind of interchanged, you know, one and two as the top-rated shows of each week. Sometimes it was All in the Family. Sometimes it was Sanford and Son.
I didn't remember.
But it wasn't extremely, it was a hugely popular show, Sanford and Son was, in its time. And, you know, inevitably, as most shows do, towards the end, it started to run out of steam. The scripts got very silly. The ratings went down. I should also mention in the third season of the show, Red staged his very famous walkout, where he walked out over salary and missed about 8 episodes of the show. At the time, it was, you know, the press made a big deal because they said, you know, he walked out because he wanted a window in his dressing room, which he didn't. That's partly true, but it really was. It was really mostly about the money. Red felt that as NBC's biggest comedy star, he wasn't being paid as much as Carol O'Connor was for All in the Family on CBS. He had a valid point. The show was doing very well, and he walked out, and he was basically AWOL for months. And while he was absent from the show, what Bud Yorkin did was to move Whitman Mayo into the lead role. He played Grady.
Huh.
And they kind of wrote Fred Sanford off as, you know, he had gone back to St. Louis to a relative's funeral. And every once in a while there'd be a scene where Grady would answer the phone and say, "Hey, it's Fred on the other end. Yeah, I'll be back soon." You know, that sort of thing. And they finally, after about almost 4 months, Red finally hammered out a deal with NBC where he got a very, very, very big pay raise. He got to own part of the show, which is what he always wanted, which he ended up losing in when he divorced his second wife, by the way.
Yeah, that's what I also wanted to get to. Here he is. He was making great money in Vegas, and then he gets this enormously popular television show on NBC. He even walks away from it to make more money. How the hell? I mean, okay, so you have a divorce and you lose half of what you got. How did he lose seemingly everything?
He, you know, if you're going to put the picture of a bad businessman in the dictionary, I think, you know, Red would be right up there. He had no sense of money and like how to invest it or how to save it. And basically, whatever came in, he spent just as quickly. First of all, he had a very steady cocaine habit, which he was very open about. He would snort coke, at the table reads for Sanford and Sonny. He wore a little spoon around his neck. He never made any apologies for that. He did start his own production company once Sanford and Son hit it big, but just through very bad investments, and he opened a beauty parlor which went nowhere. He had a business which he called car flocking, which was basically people would come in and have their cars velvetized with velvet, and somebody said, "Well, you know, what happens when it rains?" Oops, didn't think of that.
Well, because he's in Vegas, it never rains. It wouldn't be an issue. Oh my God!
So that business went bust, and
velvetize your car. That's horrifying. Okay.
He bought himself a building on La Brea Boulevard, in which he called the Red Fox Building, which is a pretty big building in Los Angeles, which he never paid the rent on.
Oh, no.
And he ended up having that taken away from him.
Because there's a scene.
Didn't pay his taxes, which at the end of his life caught up with him.
Yeah, I remember the scene, even before like the era of YouTube, of him being interviewed. He's standing in front of like the gate of his house that's been padlocked, and he's almost crying for the television cameras that he can't believe they're I don't know. It felt real, that he wasn't even staging it.
No, yeah, that was real, and I talk about that in the book. I mean, and you're right, Dave. I mean, the IRS raided his house at about 6 a.m. in the morning in 1989. He owed over $3 million in taxes.
Oh, my God.
Which he knew about. I mean, he wasn't stupid. He just, his motto was just, you know, I ain't paying. I don't care. As a matter of fact, he once said, when there's a black president, I'll pay my taxes.
He'd be in trouble now, wouldn't he?
But you're right.
How did he climb? So, okay, I mean, you figure as horrible as $3 million in back taxes sounds, one also figures, well, if he kept working on Sanford or something, he could pay it, you know. Was he able to sort of extricate himself?
He started to towards the end. After the IRS raided his house, they took virtually everything, including a wristwatch he right off his wrist that had been given to him by Elvis Presley.
Oh, my God.
They actually did, several months later, auction off. He had a whole collection of classic cars, which the IRS auctioned off to help pay back some of his debt. He ended up getting some of his stuff back. And ironically, right before he passed away, in that particular week, in October of 1991, he had just signed off on, you know, a payment schedule to start paying back everything he owed. And it looked like his career was starting to go back on the upswing. I mean, after Sanford and Son, it was pretty much a downward spiral into, endless lawsuits. I can't even begin to tell you how many lawsuits. It's all in there in the book of just everything.
Because I would figure that even though television was no longer necessarily knocking on his door, he could always go back to Vegas and do the club thing and tour.
And as one of his former managers says in the book, I mean, he could roll out of bed and make $1 million, and he did do that. But he spent the money just as quickly, and he was being sued, and he had judgments against him, and liens against houses, and so whatever he made was being spent elsewhere, whether it was his drug habit or he was addicted to Keno, which was it's a game you play in Vegas, and he spent a lot of money at the Keno tables.
Oh, for God's sakes.
Also, he was, you know, I should point this out, I mean, he was also an extremely generous man, and I try to make that point in the book, that part of his downfall was his generosity, because if you were a friend of Red's, you were a friend for life, and he would virtually give you the money out of his pocket, I mean, 100, 200 bucks, whatever. There's a story that Della Reese tells in the book about, I think it was in the late 60s, you know, she was a pretty successful singer at that point, but had fallen on hard times, and she called up Red just to say hello, and she came to see him backstage at a club he was playing at. It might have been Vegas, I don't remember. And Red sort of faked an illness, and said to the club manager, you know, I can't do the late show, I don't feel well, you know, why don't you put Della on? Which they did, and she got paid, and it sort of sparked her career again. And so he was extremely generous to a fault, which I think was part of his downfall. He never got paid back. And you mentioned before that sort of those clips of him on his driveway when the IRS came in. He does say, you know, he is almost crying, and he says, you know, I've helped so many people through my life. All I need is just one person to step forward now to help me. And, you know, no one ever did.
Well, you need someone to help him with $3 million. Somebody paying back $200 is not, you know.
He was hoping, I think, Eddie Murphy would help because he had acted in a movie called Harlem Nights, and Eddie Murphy always said how much he admired Red, and he really never did help him. He did end up paying for Red's funeral. That was always the rumor, but he didn't come through with the big money I think Red was hoping for, and So, he went out with his career just looked like it was just getting back on track. And then, as a matter of fact, I think it was, I don't remember the comedian's name. Might have been
Slappy
the guy,
White?
I forget, the guy on Comedy Central who walked away from that huge deal a couple of years ago. Anyway,
I know who you're talking about. Dave Chappelle.
Dave Chappelle, thank you. Mm-hmm. I think it was Dave Chappelle who said, he's a genius. He died right before he had to pay any money back. He just dropped dead. So, let's give the man props. He didn't have to pay any of the money back. But
and it's also pretty good to die on the upswing, like when you're hopeful and things are turning around. So it's kind of a nice, not that it's a great time to die, but hey, he went out with his boots on. Didn't he die on set?
He did, and there's, you can watch, there were clips of him. He had, one of the theories, well, first of all, I mean, his heart just gave out. He was only 68, but I mean, he had packed probably 20 more years into that life than, with just, the club life, the smoking, the cigarette, the interviews that Red gave towards the end of his life, 3 or 4 years before that, you can tell he was laboring for breath and probably had emphysema. Mm. But he did suffer a massive heart attack, but some people think that he was also, what one of the causes might have been was he was under a very, very strict watch by the CBS executives because they knew that he could be trouble on the set of a show. He had several other shows after Sanford and Son failed that he just sort of caused a lot of trouble on the set, and it always ended badly. So they were keeping a pretty tight rein on him. And that day, the day he passed away, he was giving an interview with the Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. Remember that Robin Leach show?
Sure.
And there were clips of him, and he was giving this interview backstage in another room, and one of the production assistants interrupted the interview because they said they needed Red to what they called to block a scene, which was basically not even rehearsing. They basically needed him to stand there so they could, get the camera angles right.
Sure.
And he was pissed, and he felt humiliated, and he says to the interviewer, I'm so sorry, this is embarrassing, but, let me get this done, and I'll be right back. And he's mumbling, and you can tell he's visibly angry. He walked away, went to the set, and dropped dead. So,
oh, my God.
That's, one of the theories. I mean, let's face it, the guy, as I said before, he died of a heart attack. He died of living a very hard life and not a very healthy guy. But I think, also the stress of being babysat by the network and being embarrassed like that probably didn't help.
Can I ask one of the first things you said when we started this interview? And by the way, we're talking with Michael Starr, the author of Black and Blue, The Red Fox Story, available from Applause Theater and Cinema Books, ladies and gentlemen, and all the
places. And Amazon.com and all your other places.
And also, is it electronically available?
Yeah,
Kindle,
and
everything?
I got to get all the plugs in.
Yeah.
You can get it on the Nook and Kindle and electronically and every platform you can think of. It's out there. Thank you.
Yeah, but you said that, of course, one of the best things about writing a book like this is discovering things that you've never expected or didn't know about your subject. So what were one or two things that were really, really surprising to you about Red Fox when you were writing Black and Blue?
Yeah, I think, his recording career and the fact that he was good enough, and even as you mentioned, that he was good enough to get to pass an audition and to actually be paid to put his voice on record, that surprised me. I also wasn't aware that I knew that when Red was 17, he and his several of his friends hopped a freight train illegally, in those days, what they called riding the rails, and he ended up in Harlem. But he ended up in Harlem in July of 1939. So he was almost 17. He was good enough. He got together with some other guys in the neighborhood, and they auditioned for and passed an audition to get onto Major Bowes Amateur Hour, which was it was probably the biggest radio show of its day, hosted by a guy named Major Bowes. I mean, it was listened to by 30, 40 million people. And Red, he was known as John Sanford then, was nobody, part of a little, a street corner singing group, was good enough to pass an audition and get onto national radio show, and that recording is also available. I had to get permission to listen to it. It's in the National Archives because somebody owns the Major Bowes collection.
But it's amazing listening to
John Sanford and his friends on the Major Bowes when he was 16 and a half years old on a major radio show.
Amazing.
So that amazed me. I had no idea. And I wasn't aware of his relationship also with Slappy White, who went on to his very own successful stand-up comedy career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Red and Slappy toured. They were known as Fox and White. They toured the Chitlin' Circuit. They played the Apollo Theater.
No, wait, Slappy Fox White, and... Hold on a sec. It occurs to me that they missed an amazing opportunity right there, because shouldn't they just call themselves Red and White?
You'd think, right? Red and White. I mean, I thought the same thing, no, but they went Fox and White, and... Red and White probably would have made more sense, and Red, White, and Blue, because, you know, Red was a blue comedian.
There you go.
But at that time in his life, Slappy White was married to Pearl Bailey,
oh,
who was a, you know, very big star, and I think Red was always sort of angry at her. He ended up making a movie with her years later called Norman, Is That You?
Uh-huh.
And they bickered like brother and sister on the set of that movie, because Red had always been angry at her because he felt back in 1949, 1950, she didn't do enough to help out their act, because she was obviously a much bigger name then. She was already in the movies and, you know, a big recording star. And he always felt that she should have done more to help out her husband and his partner, which was Red Fox.
Oh,
But Fox and White toured with the very great jazz singer Dinah Washington, and she brought them out to L.A. She wanted them to open as her opening act.
Wow.
It didn't quite work out, but ironically, she ended up going back east with, she took Slappy White with her as her MC, and so Red was left in L.A. on his own. That broke up the act of Fox and White. Red and Slappy remained friends for life. I mean, Slappy White was, whatever show Red Fox did, even after he made it famous on Sanford and Son, you know, a comedy show, he always had Slappy on the bill, and Slappy appeared on the first several seasons of Sanford and Son as a character named Melvin. But, you know, comedy fans know he forged a pretty good stand-up career of his own.
Yeah, sure.
It was the fact that Dinah Washington took Slappy back east with her that left Red in L.A. on his own and forced him to do his solo act, which in turn led to the Party Records, and he met his future wife, and, you know, Dootsie Williams, as I mentioned before. And so, you know, that might not ever have happened had Slappy White and Red stayed together. You know, Red might not have ever done those Party Records. Who knows? But
speaking of the personal, speaking of the personal stuff, have you had reactions from people close to either family members or close friends since the book has come out? Anybody contacting you, say, oh, this is wonderful, you made this little mistake, or what?
That's a good question, Dave. You know, when I was writing the book, I approached Red was married right around the time of Laugh at the Party, in his first big comedy record. He married a woman named Jean Harris. She was part of there was a singing group called the Harris Sisters, and they were pretty big names on their own. There were three singing sisters who charted with several hits. And Red married Jean. The marriage lasted about 25 years through the second or third season of Sanford and Son is when they broke up and they divorced. Jean is still alive. She lives in Las Vegas.
Oh.
I tried many, many times to get in touch with her. We spoke briefly several times. I emailed her. She never wanted to. She didn't answer my email. She didn't want to get involved in the book. Her daughter from her first marriage was a woman named Debrica, who, when Red married Jean, he adopted.
Uh-huh.
So Debrica took the last name of Fox, so she's always been known as Debrica Fox, who was Red's adopted daughter. I approached her, too, never heard back, you know, basically got the old crickets, you know, the emails and the phone calls, and people said they knew her, they'd pass along the message, blah, 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 never heard back. So the book was published last fall in October, and I went out to Las Vegas to do a book signing at a Barnes & Noble because, you know, Red was just a huge draw, as you mentioned, a huge draw in Las Vegas. Got a very nice turnout. And as I'm signing books, I see two older African-American women, and I'm saying to myself, I wonder if that's Jean and Debrica. But I was busy. I was signing books and talking to people. They walk over to the table where I am, and I look at her and I say, Jean? Because I knew what she looked like. And she said, yeah, that's me, you know, and she was with Debrica. We made some kind of awkward small talk. I said, you know, I did reach out to you, and I never heard back. And I had a stack of books on the table. They were looking through the book, you know, looking at the pictures. Didn't buy any books, I might add. And we made very awkward small talk, and they walked away. That's the last I heard. So I don't, you know.
Oh, I was expecting a whole different
story. You
know,
she said she was working on her own book, but she told me that, you know, 12 years ago when I first encountered her, so doubtful that's ever going to happen. So yeah, that was my really one brush with his family. Red had a manager for years named Prince Spencer, who was very well known in the 50s. Actually made a movie with Sammy Davis Jr. He was a very good dancer.
Oh,
Prince was. And when his career ended, he became sort of Red's Guy Friday, his manager. He'd do run Red's dry cleaning, run his errands for him, traveled, got his suits pressed. They were very close. He's still alive. He's about 94 now.
Wow.
And yeah, and he lives in Vegas. And I did track him down. He's not very hard to find. I got him on the phone. I got his wife on the phone. The first time she said, Prince is out at the gym. This was a guy who was 92 at the time. So she's like, call him back. So I did call him back. And he basically, long story short, he just said, listen, I'm 94. I'm tired. I've spoken all I can about Red Fox. I just want to, live out the rest of my life in peace. So I didn't really get a chance to interview him. I would have liked to have. And unfortunately, by the time I got to researching and writing this book, people like Slappy White and LaWanda Page, they've all passed on. So, I did interview a lot of people, and a lot of people who wrote for and worked with Red on Sanford and Sons, former managers of his and co-stars of his. So I did speak to a lot of people. But personally, it would have been nice to have spoken to Gene. And Red had two other wives towards the end of his life. In the mid-70s, I'm trying to think now, in the mid-70s he married a woman named, a Korean woman he called Joy.
Okay.
They were married, and Barbara Walters, when Red jumped from NBC to ABC, he was stolen away by Fred Silverman, gave him a huge, huge deal, over $1 million a year for Red to host which turned out to be a short-lived variety show on ABC. Anyway, Fred Silverman at that time had also stolen Barbara Walters away from NBC, so he stole Barbara Walters and Red Fox away. And sort of to welcome Red to ABC, Barbara Walters did a primetime interview special where she interviewed Red.
Mm-hmm.
And his then wife Joy, who was at that time was his third wife, but I couldn't find Joy. Red was married to Joy for about 6 years. Most people told me that she was really the love of his life, and even after they were divorced, he would always buy her flowers on her birthday, and they kept in touch for a little while. But I couldn't find her. And then towards the end of his life, I'd say the last 2 years, he was involved with another Korean woman named Kaho, who he married in the summer of 91, right, several months before his death.
Right.
Truth be told, she wasn't very well liked by Red's intimates, and she kind of disappeared from sight. I couldn't find her either. But she was with him when he died, and she was with him on the set when he died. So she certainly holds a very distinct place in the life and the death of Red Fox.
Well, the life and the death of Red Fox is what we have been covering here with Michael Starr, the author of Black and Blue, The Red Fox Story, available from Applause Books on Amazon, of course, and all the usual ways you get books these days. Can I ask you, Michael, before we let you go, who's your next subject?
I have just signed a deal to do a biography of Ringo Starr, as a matter of fact.
Whoa!
The last name is strictly a very happy coincidence, but nobody's ever really done an in-depth bio of Ringo. We all know the John Lennon and Paul McCartney and to an extent George Harrison, but I'd like to do a book about Ringo, just signed a deal, and that hopefully will be coming out in a couple of years.
Well, do you have access, or do you have to go around Ringo?
Dave, I'm having trouble hearing you, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have access to first person?
I lost you. Okay. Anyway, thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Michael, can you hear me at all? Michael,
now I can hear you. I lost it there for a second.
Okay. My one question was, are you going to have first-person access to Ringo Starr, or do you have to ask everybody else about him?
Remains to be seen at this point. The deal has just been finalized, so I will approach Ringo. I'm going to say he probably won't talk to me, but you never know.
So it really doesn't matter to the publishers. They want you to do the book.
No,
whether
as
or
long
not.
As you can get the inside story, and obviously he's a big enough name, and his wife has been very public, but when you do these sorts of books, you always want to find out maybe and educate people on some things maybe they might not have known. So obviously we all know about the Beatles, but what about before that and his life since. So hopefully that will work out, and maybe we'll be talking about that in a couple of years.
That would be great. I can't wait to read it. Also, everybody know that Michael Starr has written books about Art Carney and Joey Bishop and Raymond Burr, and, of course, the book we've been talking about, Black and Blue, The Red Fox Story. Thank you so much for...
Thank you, Dave. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, Michael. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Thanks,
now.
You too.